From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as the Trump White House proposes big cuts to EPA funding and staff, a leading water scientist is more worried than ever about Lake Erie with its burning polluted waters of the past.
Without a strong EPA, Lake Erie is likely to continue to deteriorate and go back to the conditions that we had in the 1970s.
Grand Rapids police try to reassure anxious immigrants in West Michigan.
If you're a resident of Grand Rapids, regardless of your immigration status, if you call us for help, we're here to provide that help.
Solving working class problems not through government, but through boardrooms.
Gen X and millennials believe that what business does matters. It ought not be just what can you do as a business person. It ought to be what should you do.
Those stories and much more on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As the Trump administration proposes cuts to EPA funding and staffing, a leading scientist believes without EPA support and protection, Lake Erie could once again become a poster child of pollution.
When we think historically, where we are right now, these blooms that we see on Lake Erie, this is exactly where we were in the 1970s.
That is later in this hour. But first, do not be afraid to call us. That's what Grand Rapids Police Chief David Rahinsky told a recent meeting of anxious people at the Hispanic Center of West Michigan, people who do not know how and if President Trump's immigration crackdown involves local police agencies.
We're here to help on a community level. If you're a resident of Grand Rapids, regardless of your immigration status, if you call us for help, we're here to provide that help.
Chief David Rahinsky is with us now. And Chief, why did you feel that you needed to step up and make that clear statement at that meeting?
Well, to the credit of our Hispanic community, they were expressing concern. And the last thing we want them to be reluctant to do is reach out to our agency if they're the victim of crime or if they witness a crime. So I wanted to make it clear the differences between federal immigration policy and local policing.
And what do you worry will happen if these people become so worried about deportation that they don't call your officers?
Well, the relationship that we've invested in and that we've developed over the years has really led to a decrease in crime in Grand Rapids. We've got relationships built on trust. They're quick to come forward when they witness a crime. They're quick to assist the department in investigating crimes. We've been very proactive in terms of not allowing a gang presence in our city, and that's in part due to those relationships. So what I don't want to see happen is those relationships deteriorate. But just as importantly is I don't want someone who's a victim of crime, someone who may be in a domestic relationship where they're being battered, someone who comes home and their apartment's been burglarized, or someone who comes home to find that a grandmother or a young child is missing. And because of their immigration status, they're afraid to call 911 to get the help that we're here to provide.
We're seeing very clear signs the president expects to use local officers to enforce federal immigration law. He's reviving a vintage program that deputizes local officers to do that very thing, and that's drawing a lot of attention in Arizona. Are you feeling as though you and your officers are being kind of put between the proverbial rock and a hard place?
My fear is that, particularly for first-generation immigrants, the difference between federal, state, and local law enforcement can be confusing. If English isn't your native language, you know, policia, everyone who wears a badge is authorized to make an arrest. So what I'm trying to stress to our Hispanic community is we're not ICE agents. We're not here to pick up and to enforce people who are here undocumented. What we're here to do is provide a safe community for the residents of Grand Rapids, regardless of that status.
Certainly, your feelings and your message to the people at the Hispanic Center of West Michigan echo an open letter that's just been released by a group of 61 police chiefs from all across the country, including Dearborn Chief Ronald Haddad, basically pleading with the president and senators to not pull local police departments into this federal immigration enforcement. So this really does, in a sense, harm locally based community oriented policing.
I have no doubt that if we were forced into that role of serving as an extension of the federal enforcement agencies in terms of immigration policy, that would hurt our ability to police our communities. So I respect the role of the federal government. I think they, in turn, need to respect the role of municipal police departments in terms of making our communities as safe as they can be for all of our residents.
We're hearing and reading more and more signs that the president and his team and Homeland Security are taking a closer and harder look at hundreds of sanctuary cities to see which should lose federal funding. So in a sense that if you give safe haven to undocumented immigrants, you're at risk of losing federal funding. And I'm just wondering, what's your take on what constitutes a sanctuary jurisdiction? Is that even clear?
It's a great point. There is no real clear line of demarcation in terms of what constitutes a sanctuary city. What I don't support is if an agency arrests someone who was here illegally and books them into their either their municipal jail facility or their county facility, I believe we have an obligation to notify our federal counterparts in ICE, in Customs and Immigration Enforcement, of that arrest. So from my interpretation of a sanctuary city, it's one that isn't cooperating in terms of the role that our federal counterparts are playing in terms of policing immigration. So I think there is definitely a role. I just don't think it's one that the local authorities, the policemen who walk your neighborhoods, the policemen who your kids get to know through their various outreach programs, I don't think that should be our role. And I think that's a discussion that we in law enforcement need to be having at the local, state, and federal level in terms of being respectful for the relationships that we've developed and making sure that we don't take a step backwards.
When you stand before the immigrant community in West Michigan and say, trust us, you don't need to be afraid to call us, immigration status won't matter to our officers if you call, how can these people trust you? How do you convince them to trust you?
It's very difficult, and that's why they need to hear it continually, and that's why the relationships that we've already built up are so important. But having said that, inevitably there'll be stories, anecdotal, of someone who was stopped for a traffic violation, who may have had an outstanding warrant, who ultimately gets booked into a county facility and may end up deported. So what we need to explain in very clear terms is if you're the victim of a crime, if you need police help, your immigration status is not an issue with us. Conversely, if you're a criminal and you're here illegally, we're not offering safe haven. We're not neglecting our role in law enforcement. We're just making a very clear line of demarcation in terms of people who need our help and the criminal element. And just because someone is here undocumented doesn't necessarily put them in a criminal context in terms of municipal law enforcement and providing that assistance.
Grand Rapids Police Chief David Rahinsky, thank you so much for taking our questions.
Thank you.
Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan is claiming that former emergency manager Kevin Orr misled him during the city's bankruptcy, and he's threatening to sue. But are there some political reasons behind the mayor's accusations? Let's ask Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, who is with us every Thursday. Daniel, exactly what's Mayor Duggan's accusation against Orr and his law firm Jones Day?
Essentially, the Kevin Orr and his team lowballed the what it would cost the city to pay on pensions starting in 2024. It's important to note that the city is in the middle of a 10-year pension holiday. But in 2024, they're going to have to start paying. And initially, the deal said it's going to be about $114 million a year. As the Duggan administration dug into this more recently, they've come to the conclusion that even with the decent returns on the market, because those dollars are traded in the market, mm-hmm. it could be about $167 million, which means it's about $53 million a year more expensive, or almost 50% more. If they don't get any returns, they've estimated that number could swell to as high as $344 million, which is roughly $230 million more, or about double what they expected, or triple what they expected.
Now, that must have been an eye-popping moment for them to kind of dig in there and discover the reality.
It is, if in fact that's what happened. I mean, the allegation here is that they misled. The important thing here is the allegation that Orr and Company misled the city. And I think that's going to be the real debate as to whether or not they go forward here. Now, in bankruptcy and in the plan of adjustment, there's all sorts of qualifications and caveats saying these are estimates. The other thing that's important to note is that in general, the lawyers and professionals associated with the bankruptcy are indemnified against litigation once the plan has been approved by the court. There's like about a 10-day period where they could, in theory, challenge it. But that, of course, is long gone. So that's why you have the mayor saying, well, we're going to look at this and we might do it. And we wouldn't do it if we don't think we could win.
So what kind of political dividends could Mayor Duggan be reaping from all of this?
Well, let's start at the top. It's an election year. Mm-hmm. The mayor is running for re-election. He's running against, so far, a person with probably the most potent political name in post-war Detroit history, and that is Coleman Young.
Yeah.
And he also, despite, I think, a lot of very positives for the mayor, There's these lingering suspicions that he has, from the jump, actually been supportive of the emergency manager law, was working with, and if you might use the word conspiring, with the Republican legislature and Governor Rick Snyder to essentially take Detroit through bankruptcy and slowly kind of winnow away some of its assets and some of its home rule. This is an opportunity to kind of make the allegation that, hey, I'm opposed to the emergency manager law, and this emergency manager took advantage of the city and the fancy law firm that he came from, Jones Day, who represented the city, fleeced the city. And the reality of politics is that you can make that charge, and you don't need to file a lawsuit. And so that's what I think is the biggest political dividend, is the charge can linger out there. And I think this also signifies kind of one of the things that the mayor may be concerned about is he's thinking about and preparing for a reelection campaign is what's it going to cost him and what is he going to have to fight against to get through and win that Democratic primary, which, as most people know in Detroit, is what really matters. And that's the primary in August of this year, not the general election in November.
And you note in today's column, there's some interesting ironies here.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a mayor who came to office with the emergency manager in bankruptcy, having done a lot of the dirty work for him. I mean, the reality is that a lot of the change in the financial restructuring and the operational restructuring that was begun under Kevin Orr and continued under the mayor, he never would have been able to get that going under normal course of business. Emergency management and bankruptcy was a big friend to Mayor Duggan and, frankly, to the city council. A lot of difficult things were done, and people could say, hey, we didn't do that. That was the bankruptcy process. That was the emergency manager. But they reaped the benefit. So I think, and one of the reasons you see a lot of private sector investment, not just Dan Gilbert, but other people investing in the city of Detroit, is they're starting to see a government that actually works and operates the way a government should be operating in this day and age. And that gives them some confidence. And the same thing with the police department. You see under James Craig, you see some leadership that they're really getting their arms around things. We have not had some of the urban problems, some of the upsets that they've had in other cities around the country in the last few years. And part of that has to do with the leadership both at City Hall and in the police department.
And as you say in your column today, if the campaign tactic tarnishes the reputations of Orr and Jones Day,
that's just the price of politics in Detroit, proving that no good deed goes unpunished around here.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Ever find yourself wondering just what Michigan looked like before the lumber boom of the 1800s created fortunes and cleared forests? Well, wonder no longer. You can still find some old-growth tree groves around the state, groves which survived Paul Bunyan's axe. Donald Dickman is a professor emeritus at Michigan State University's Department of Forestry and co-author of the book, The Forests of Michigan. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
There was such a huge growth in lumbering in Michigan from, let's say, the mid-1800s to those first few years of the 1900s. Do we have any idea how much of Michigan's forests were cleared during the lumbering boom?
Well, I can't give you an exact figure, but I would say mostly all of it was cleared at one time or another, beginning, as you said, about 1850 and continuing into the 1920s. There wasn't much left after they were through.
So how did these stands that we're going to talk about, these stands of original forest, how do you think they survived that lumbering boom?
Those that were not disturbed after the lumbering boom tended to come back to the kind of forest they were before. Of course, they were young forests. It would take them a long time to get back to the stature that they were prior to lumbering. But there were many catastrophic forest fires that followed the logging, and that set back many places almost to zero. It took many years for these areas that were logged, then burned, to recover.
So as we talk about where people can go to get a good idea of what Michigan's early forests look like, first of all, we're walking back in time. Like, how far back in time do these old forests take us?
Well, it depends on the kind of forest we're talking about. The old forest of pine could grow for 500 or even 600 years. So taking us back in time, it would be about that distance. Other forests are somewhat shorter lived and maybe would not take us as far back, but we're talking several hundred years in most cases.
So take us through the state, if you will, a little bit, Professor Dickman, starting maybe with the Upper Peninsula and heading south. Where do you think some of the best remnants of early Michigan forests can be found?
Well, the Upper Peninsula does have a few spots that would give you a good idea of the type of forests that grew in that area. Porcupine Mountains State Park, which is our largest state park, contains tracts of old-growth forest. Not every part of porcupines is old-growth, but there are some good stands of pine and the hardwoods that grow in that part of the UP. So that would be a good place to go, I would say. Nearby, in the Keweenaw Peninsula, there's a wonderful place. It's not very large, but it contains some beautiful old-growth white pine trees, and it's one of my favorite old-growth spots in the state. It's right at the tip of the Keweenaw Peninsula, right above Copper Harbor.
I remember as a kid being taken by my parents when we were camping in the northern Lower Peninsula, going to Hartwick Pines.
Sure.
Near Grayling. Is that a good spot still?
Yeah, that's the Lower Peninsula now, but as far as a place to see old-growth pine, that's pretty much it in the Lower Peninsula. That's a state park also. It has a wonderful recreation of a logging camp, a wonderful museum, a good interpretation, and it's right off of I-75, hard to miss.
Indeed, indeed. What are some other favorite spots of yours?
Well, in the Lower Peninsula, upper Lower Peninsula, there are some nice pines at Interlochen Park also, which is just southwest of Traverse City. Sleeping Bear Dunes has a few spots where you can see old-growth timber and a lot of other wonderful natural sites.
And if we move into the southern Lower Peninsula, what strikes you?
Well, there are several places there where you can see the old-growth hardwood forest. Now, when you get to the Lower Peninsula, the southern Lower Peninsula, it's mostly hardwood forests that we'd be looking at. Warren Woods, down in the far southwest corner of the state, is a good place to see an old-growth beech maple forest. Right here on the Michigan State campus, there's a place called Toomey Woods. It's a little hard to find if you don't know what you're looking for, but it has been designated by the National Park Service as a national natural landmark because, as far as we know, it has never been logged or disturbed in a major way. So there are a couple places. Oh, one more that I really want to mention because it contains some really massive old-growth trees, and that is the Newton Woods in Russ Forest, which is near Dowagiac. Huh. It's also a Michigan State property. And once you find your way to Russ Forest, it's pretty easy to find Newton Woods, and it's worth taking the trail there to see some really big hardwood trees.
Professor, I'm wondering what drew you to forestry and studying trees?
That's a good question. I've always been interested in the outdoors. Our family, when I was growing up, spent time in the north woods of Wisconsin, and those experiences stuck with me. And when I was trying to decide what I was going to do with my life, just one day forestry popped into my mind, and I did some exploration. I ended up going to the University of Washington for my undergraduate degree, and from the first day, practically, I knew I was in the right spot.
I'm wondering, as you stand in these early forests, in these old growth stands, what do you find yourself thinking about?
Well, that also is a very good question. I guess it's just the otherworldliness of it and the fact that you're away from the cell phone traffic and the computers and the hustle and bustle of everyday life and the politics and all the rest of it. It's a place to really kind of get into yourself and relax and think about the natural world and how it functions, how it relates to us as human beings. It's just a whole different mind thought that goes on when I step into these places. It's really something that I need to do periodically.
As we talk about these remnants of Michigan's early forests, are they self-sustaining? You know, if we mine them well, will they be here in another 100 years?
Well, that's a good question, Cindy. Nothing is permanent, you know. Hartwick pines, the big pines there, are slowly dying, falling over, sometimes just of their own massive weight, they will fall over. So, no, they're not permanent. But the various agencies that manage our forests, the National Park Service, the U.S. Forest Service, and the National Forest, the State Forest, they all have plans that they are implementing to set aside areas for future old growth. Areas that will not be disturbed, will not be logged, will be protected and allowed through their natural course of growing to become natural forests with large trees.
There is a link from the state DNR listing remnants of Michigan's old forest, some of the locations that Professor Dickman talked about. We have put that on the stateside page at michiganradio.org, so you can plan your visits back in time by visiting these original forests. Donald Dickman, Professor Emeritus at Michigan State University's Department of Forestry and co-author of The Forests of Michigan. Thank you for sharing your passion with us, Professor.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
Making music, dancing, acting, creating art. Getting kids started at an early age with the arts, and the payoff could be better literacy, math, and science skills, and overall learning skills. That's the idea behind the Living Arts Detroit Wolf Trap program, narrowing the achievement gap between affluent and less affluent areas through arts education. That was Detroit Wolf Trap teaching artist Rachel McIntosh and her class. She's a singer with the Michigan Opera Theater and also plays piano and Celtic harp. And with us today is Susanna Goodman, the Detroit Wolf Trap program manager. It's a pleasure to have you both with us.
Thank you, Susanna.
Yeah, thanks for having
us.
Susanna, break it down for us just exactly how the Detroit Wolf Trap program works.
How it works. So overall, Living Arts is an organization that places teaching artists of the highest caliber in classrooms with students. And Wolf Trap is our program for early learners. So we actually work with students as young as 3 months, all the way up through kindergarten. And Wolf Trap focuses on the performing arts in particular. So we place talented artists like Rachel, opera singers and puppeteers and actors and dancers in Head Start classrooms mostly, but other types of preschool classrooms as well, to equip the teachers in the classrooms with greater art strategies to include more students. The residency is tailored to the needs of that classroom and the professional development goals of the classroom teachers.
This is stunning to think, starting from age 6 down to 3 months. What's the benefit of bringing arts into the lives of kids that are so young?
What we see our work as doing is laying the groundwork. Math at age 3 months might not seem like something that's easy to see, but when you recognize the importance of music in laying the cognitive groundwork for recognizing patterns, for understanding the relationship of part to whole, for building recognition of number words and symbols, it's something that you can really start at an early age using music, using movement, using dance. And an important early math skill is understanding the relationship of the part to the whole. So pretty much in every classroom, there's a number of the day. Mm-hmm. And the number of the day is to help the students become aware of that number, what it looks like, how they can count to that number. But one thing that the arts and Wolf Trap in particular bring to the number of the day is an embodied experience of that number. One of our dance teaching artists has a practice of having students grow from the floor to as tall as they can possibly be to the number of the day. So if the number of the day is 8, what does the number 2 look like in their body? What does the number 4 look like in their body? Mm-hmm. What does the number 7 look like in their body? We think of that as fractions as adults. Expecting 4-year-olds to understand that concept is really abstract, but this lays the groundwork for that mathematical thinking that they'll use later in life.
And then how do you teach the scientific method through theater?
Theater is a great way of understanding sequencing as well as roles. Early science doesn't necessarily look like 4-year-olds playing with beakers in their classroom. But early science skills are things like observing, experimenting, predicting results, drawing conclusions, and using tools to achieve their goals. So some of our science-related residencies have been really a great opportunity for students to problem solve using the tools at hand, which goes back and forth between science and engineering techniques, evaluating if their experiments worked, revising, making new plans, and then making decisions as a group and deciding if their work had been successful or not. That's the scientific method. Those are things that that you work on later in life too. But if you can lay that groundwork through imaginative theatrical play, you're really setting yourself up for success.
Yeah. Speaking of science, I understand one of the lessons that you teach, Rachel, is about how flowers grow. Let's take a listen.
Let's say, come out, Mr. Sun.
Come out, Mr. Sun.
The sun shines on the garden, oh yes. The sun shines on the garden, oh yes. Grow your garden.
garden today. And everybody, let's take a seat. The first thing that we did was what? We dug a hole in the garden. That's the first part of the pattern. Then, what did we do next?
Seeds.
We put seeds in the garden. Then what did we need?
Water.
The water, the rain fell on the garden. And then
the sun.
They sound like they're having a lot of fun. You probably see this in your classroom, Rachel, when you're working with the youngsters. They don't even know what they're learning. They're having a good time.
Yeah, exactly. They're experiencing everything. And there's so many other skills that we can learn, like moving, taking turns, things that we as adults don't really think about very much because it's just second nature. But those gross motor skills and social emotional skills are really important. And, you know, doing something as simple as just saying, like, this is happy and this is sad can really make a difference for a child who doesn't necessarily have words to express their feelings.
So you're planting seeds at this very, very early
exactly.
age that you figure are going to be kind of growing as they go through their lives, really, not just through grade school. Or this is lifelong skills they're going to pick up.
Absolutely. Right.
Tell us about some of the other lessons that you teach, Rachel.
Yeah, so everything is literacy-based with Wolf Trap. So we usually, more than 90% of the time, I'm using a book. And from that book, we create songs and dance and movement and different kinds of things. So we start usually with a routine, some kind of a warm-up. I like to do this song that I call, like, I'm Feeling Happy. And the kids, we all sing, I'm feeling happy. And then they all get to show how they move their body when they're feeling happy. And it's great because it gives each student a chance to express themselves and to be the center of the attention, as well as the other students, gives them a chance to listen and observe and learn how to do that in a respectful way.
And it gets the kids who might be a little more retiring and shy out into the spotlight in a supportive way. Because we always know there's the ham in every class that cannot wait to jump into the center.
Yeah. exactly. There's usually a few of those.
And that's actually one of the biggest pieces of feedback we've heard from classroom teachers who we know understand their kids, the arc of their learning better than anyone else. They say that this program empowers the shyest students and also creates avenues for their more energetic students to direct their energy back into the learning.
Delicately put, the more energetic students. Rachel, I know your degree at the University of Michigan is in vocal performance and music education, so you are a trained music educator.
I am.
But not all the artists, the teaching artists in the program are. What kind of training do they get for getting them into that classroom?
So all of our Wolf Trap artists nationwide and all of them at Detroit Wolf Trap have been trained by the national organization. We bring in trainers once or twice a year to reinforce that model that has been honed in on over many years of work. All of the affiliates provide feedback each year. It's a community of learners and teachers who are constantly improving the program to improve the outcomes for the students.
What do the numbers tell you with respect to what kind of performance you see from youngsters that have been through this kind of training versus the ones who haven't?
First of all, we do know nationwide that students who have preschool do better in school all the way to college graduation or high school graduation. But one way that we know that our programs work, which we're confident of, is that all of the classrooms that we provide service on are evaluated already by their teachers. The teachers make anecdotal notes throughout the year. And we actually collect data on all of the students that receive the program and compare it to students who do not receive the program. And each year we get different types of results. But last year was really conclusive in that on every single developmental domain, our students did significantly better than their peers who did not receive the program. Those domains are approaches to learning, social and emotional development, physical development, language and literacy, math, creative arts, science, and technology and social studies.
You're hardwiring these kids at this very early age. I can really see what you're saying now, the importance of starting so young when they're soaking everything up.
Exactly.
It's pretty amazing that a 16-session residency, which is the model for our Wolf Trap programs, 16 30-minute sessions, 16 30-minute experiences with amazing professional artists like Rachel can change a lifetime of learning.
Susanna Goodman and Rachel McIntosh with the Living Arts Detroit Wolf Trap program. We want to thank you so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Yeah,
thank you.
We will let Wolf Trap teaching artist Rachel McIntosh and her class take us out with their goodbye song.
Now we say goodbye. Now we say goodbye. Our pleasant work is done. Our pleasant work is done. Goodbye.
Then.
Goodbye. Until the morning sun. Until the morning sun.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This is an especially precarious time for Lake Erie's future, says our next guest. Ohio State University professor Jeffrey Reuter is an aquatic biologist and limnologist. He has been studying and working on Lake Erie since 1971, and he believes if we lose the EPA, we lose Lake Erie. And while the Trump administration isn't proposing the complete eradication of the department, the Washington Post this week reports the White House is proposing to cut staff at the EPA by a fifth and cut its budget from $8.2 billion a year to $6.1 billion. Jeffrey, you've been working on Lake Erie, studying Lake Erie for nearly 50 years. How worried are you right now about its future?
Well, Cynthia, I'm really quite worried. When we look historically at Lake Erie, and I'm going to talk now about the importance of EPA, and not just EPA, but really all the federal agencies that are involved with the management of this wonderful lake. In 69, when the Cuyahoga River burned, Lake Erie became the poster child for pollution problems in this country. As a country, as citizens, we had reached the point where we were fed up. The very next year, EPA is formed, NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We have the first Earth Day. The year after that, the predecessor of Environment and Climate Change Canada is formed. The year after that, 72, we have the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement between U.S. and Canada.
It was a huge wake-up call, wasn't it?
It was. It was a tremendous wake-up call. It invigorated the citizens, and quite frankly, it invigorated Congress on both sides. The elected officials on the Canadian side, the signing of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, and that was Trudeau the senior and Nixon at the time that signed that in April of 72. That allows scientists on both sides of the border to work together and set targets to say, okay, how much do we need to reduce the pollution going into Lake Erie so that we can restore it and it will no longer be the dead lake?
And that worked.
Oh my gosh, it was a huge improvement. And Lake Erie went from being a dead lake. I love the quote from Johnny Carson in 1976, and he said, I heard Lake Erie was the place fish go to die. And it went from the dead lake image to the walleye capital of the world. And it was EPA and NOAA and U.S. Geological Survey. These agencies, along with state governments, Ohio EPA, Michigan DEQ, working together with the province of Ontario, Canada. You know, Lake Erie is incredibly challenging to manage.
Yeah, I'm wondering, what can you tell us, Jeffrey, about why Lake Erie is so especially vulnerable?
You need to compare it to the other Great Lakes. Lake Erie is the southernmost, the shallowest, and the warmest. The other lakes are all more than 750 feet deep. Lake Superior, 1,333 feet deep. Deepest spot in Lake Erie is 210 feet. That's down right about the border between New York and Ontario and the Eastern Basin. The whole western basin of the lake is at an average depth of only 24 feet. And it's also the southernmost. If it's the shallowest and the southernmost, it's also the warmest. And when we compare the watersheds around the other lakes in Lake Erie, we see that Lake Erie has by far the most agriculture in its watershed. It has the most urban, suburban land, and it has the least forest. That means that we're going to get more nutrients, more sediment. If you have a warm, shallow lake and you give it, you know, the most nutrients, it means that Lake Erie is going to be much more biologically productive than the other Great Lakes.
And we've been hearing from scientists like you that when we see these blooms on the lake, that is a huge warning sign, right?
Absolutely. And when we think historically, where we are right now, these blooms that we see on Lake Erie, this is exactly where we were in the 1970s. And we had the Clean Water Act passed shortly after the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement. Also in 1972, enforced by U.S. EPA. In those days, the primary source of phosphorus, which leads to the harmful algal blooms, the primary source was incredibly poor sewage treatment. The Clean Water Act allowed us to regulate and clean up the sewage treatment plants. Unfortunately, since the mid-1990s, the amount of phosphorus has been increasing, and we're sort of back to where we were in the 1970s. I like to tell people, you know, we're right now fighting the third battle of Lake Erie. Oliver Hazard Perry fought the first one, War of 1812. Second one was in the 70s and the 80s. Two countries, U.S. and Canada, working together. We solved the problem. We went from the dead lake to really the walleye capital of the world and the best example in the world of ecosystem recovery. We really need a strong EPA to help us fight this third battle, get the phosphorus levels back down to where they should be. Most of the phosphorus nowadays comes from agricultural runoff, but the algae don't really care. We still have issues with sewage treatment and septic tanks, but the vast majority is coming from agricultural runoff, and our goal is to keep ag production high but keep the nutrients on the fields.
What a balancing act. And we know that this budget proposal from the White House is exactly that. It's a proposal. It needs to go through Congress and the appropriations process. But if we see the Environmental Protection Agency weakened, you know, if the EPA essentially goes away, what do you fear for Lake Erie?
Lake Erie won't manage itself. Without a strong EPA, Lake Erie is likely to continue to deteriorate and go back to the conditions that we had in the 1970s. You need a strong EPA. You need strong state EPAs and departments of environmental quality. And those are very much dependent upon having a strong U.S. EPA. You know, the name itself, it's Environmental Protection Agency. And it's their job to protect the environment for all the citizens of the country. When I say that I'm concerned about Lake Erie, I'm not meaning that lake's going to dry up and go away, but our ability to use the lake. When we solved this problem the first time in the 1970s, the walleye harvest in Ohio went from 112,000 fish in 1976 to over 5 million by the mid-1980s.
Wow.
Small business development along the shoreline. We look at individual charter fishing businesses, each one representing a small business. Went from 34 in 1975 to over 1,200 by the mid-1980s. Businesses along the shoreline went from 207 up to 425. So the bottom line is the healthy environment also was a huge stimulus to the economy. Think of your slogan in Michigan, Pure Michigan. You want that slogan to mean something.
What I'm picking up here is that thinking of the progress that was made starting in the early 70s, it's easy to get complacent, isn't it, to think, okay, we have ticked that box, we have fixed that problem, move on.
It's good that you said that, Cynthia, because that's exactly what happened to us in the 1980s. When this crisis hit with the burning of the Cuyahoga, we respond, both countries, U.S. and Canada, working together, we solve this problem. We get to the mid-1980s, the lake's the walleye capital of the world. We greatly reduced our monitoring of the lake. We greatly reduced the amount of research that was going on the lake because, quite frankly, we thought we had the problem solved. And the problem came back. If there's anything that we have learned from what we've observed on Lake Erie, it's that you can't take this for granted. This problem is never solved. It has to be continually monitored because it's too easy for us to slip into complacency and see the lake go in the wrong direction.
Jeffrey Reuter is the retired director and current special advisor of the Ohio Sea Grant Program. He's an aquatic biologist and a limnologist with Ohio State University. Good words of warning, and thank you for that perspective of history. There's nothing like the better part of 50 years of studying something to really give us that great perspective. Thank you so very much.
Take care.
Government failed Flint. It's pretty tough to dispute that statement, knowing what we all do about how the Flint water crisis came to be and how it was dismissed and denied by bureaucrats and officials at all levels of government. Entrepreneur, investor, and philanthropist Joseph Sandberg believes we should work through the boardroom to help address working class problems, not wait for government. He's the investing founder of the home meal delivery service Blue Apron, and he's the co-founder of the online financial firm Aspiration. It lets people pay what they think is fair for their services. He's speaking in Flint tomorrow and in Lansing on Saturday, and he is with us now. Joe, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You argue that the best way to push for progressive policies and initiatives is through boardrooms, not in state capitals, not in the Beltway. Why is that?
Well, I think it's one of the important ways. I think that we should use every tool at our avail. And that means politics, public policy, philanthropy, and using business as a force for good. But if you look over the past 30 years, the progressive movement hasn't enough utilized business as a force for good, that our interaction with business has been only in setting regulations. And setting regulations for business is really important. What also is important is the kind of businesses that exist. I think in particular, Gen X and millennials believe that what business does matters, that there ought to be a different standard for business leadership. It ought not be just what can you do as a business person. It ought to be what should you do as a business person. You know, moreover, when you look at business people who've been leaders in the progressive movement, they aren't always called to account for how they made their money and what their businesses do. But your values either mean everything or nothing. And if you're a progressive, that also means that what your business does and how you conduct your private sector life needs to be aligned with your values, or your values aren't authentic. With the power of the internet, there's so many new ways that we can use business as a force to create real change and actually fix things. Fix things that are broken, like the food sector's inability to reach so many working families who are afflicted by food deserts. How the financial industry has failed to serve almost everyone, and how it creates a misalignment between what's good for the company and what's good for people. Those are examples of problems that we can actually fix by creating different kinds of businesses with different models that are purposed to solving problems and serving people rather than serving themselves. My vision for business is profit is fine, and it ought to be a byproduct, though, of doing good in the world and serving people, rather than the intention itself of a business.
I'm thinking of a quote. I see you were quoted at a recent speech, and I thought it was an intriguing quote. Here is what you said. We're coming off this era where capitalism has been kidnapped by this godlessness that treats people like mathematical variables of consumption and production.
Yes, I believe that. And I think what cuts across business, political, media, and academic leadership over the last 30 years is this. We've come to treat people as units of things, units of votes, units of consumption, units of production, units of viewership, all things that can be reduced into letters or numbers. That there's almost this view in leadership that if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. And we've become unanchored from what actually makes us special, which is we're all human. And by being human, if you believe that being human means that there's something special that can't be measured, then that ought to inform how you build organizations, how you treat people as a business, how you treat people as a leader, right? But if you don't view people as human beings, if you view them instead as cells that can be moved around in Microsoft, then it leads us to the really bad outcomes and bad views of leadership that have failed places like Flint. Because if you don't see people as humans, then you don't understand the moral charge to treat everyone as important because they are important. Instead, you end up in a place where you can sacrifice the well-being of some or many to advance the prosperity of others. Simply put, this view of leadership, unanchored from humanity, has led us to this place where we can justify so many things in the name of aggregate prosperity and aggregate GDP.
Joe, I think conventional wisdom certainly leans toward the view that the Republican Party has, shall we say, cornered the market on corporate interests with its platform that favors lower taxes and fewer regulations and other business-friendly policies. Why would CEOs and other business leaders be interested in what you're selling? What is your sales pitch to them?
My message isn't directed to CEOs. It's directed to people. Because the way we change corporate behavior is by pulling those corporations through our collective power as consumers. One of the great chances we have as progressives is to expand our view of organizing to also include how we organize ourselves as consumers. The power of our money is significant, but we deeply underutilize it. I think there's a movement afoot now, in particular in the wake of the election, that people want to match their money and their values. They want to bank with places that don't use their deposits to fund morally reprehensible projects. They want to invest their money in ways that are aligned with their values, and they want to spend their money in ways that are aligned with their values. Of course, I care about speaking directly to CEOs and getting them to change their behavior, but the much more significant opportunity is creating a movement among all of us as consumers to pull businesses toward the good through the power of our collective spend, investing, and consumption.
As you speak to the Rotary Club of Flint tomorrow, you're going to have business and community leaders in front of you. How are you going to be tailoring your national message to fit what's happened there?
Well, first, it's going to be a message of solidarity that the pain of those in Flint is my pain. It's all of our pain because we're all interconnected as humans and we're all in this together and we all rise or fall together. It's a message that I think those in Flint need to project onto leaders in Flint and everywhere else, that we matter because we're all in this together. And the path forward for business, politics, media, and leadership across the board is starting with that first principle, the why. Why does it matter that we actually have to fix things? Why is it morally outrageous that something like Flint happens? Because we're humans. Because our lives mean something. Because there's something special about being human. We can't let this happen to other people, that, you know, we have to reinvigorate a sense of solidarity. And that if you believe that, there's a very specific vision for leadership that you have, which first starts with you have to fix things. And if you believe the stakes are really high, then you don't settle for incremental change. You're unsatisfied by anything less than wholesale change that actually fixes the pain and suffering that afflicts so many people. You know, we're all almost suffering in some way or another. And that's why we're all in this together. 75% of Americans can't weather a $700 financial shock. That means that three-fourths of us are living in this constant state of financial stress, financial anxiety, looking over our shoulders, wondering, well, if a family member gets sick, if something happens to my car, something happens to my apartment, will I be able to weather that financial shock? And if you're living like that, you're not able to be your best self. And we all experience those kinds of anxieties at one time or another. The difference between being high income, middle income, and low income is, do you experience that kind of stress once a year or once every couple of years? Or do you experience that kind of stress every single minute of the day? But it's an experience that brings us all together because it's fundamentally a human experience. And when we remember that it's a human experience, we see that we're in this together, and we recognize why it's crucial that we actually fix things.
Entrepreneur, investor, and philanthropist Joe Sandberg will be speaking to the Flint Rotary Club tomorrow and then at the Michigan Progressive Summit in Lansing on Saturday. Thanks for spending time with us today, Joe.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Lise Mesmer, and Cass Adair. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.